My task is very easy. Just to see to the election of the chairperson, according to rule 130 of the rules, members must elect one of them to perish in the absence of the chairperson. So can I get any nomination? I'm sorry, I heard it.
Thank you, Marco. And then I'd like to welcome the members of the committee into the meeting, plus the department itself. Actually, I wish the parliament operated as the way this political committee is operating so swiftly in dealing with the issue. Thanks a lot for today's meeting. First of all, I'd like to apologize for being late. Because very unfortunately today, I had to go through two accidents. Different accidents. That next one next to the Montezal Road, the other one on the N2. So the car was stuck, it's not moved. So that's why I was late, not out of disrespect for this meeting. Yeah. And then, as the content advisor has said, the Honorable Pap is undergoing operation this afternoon. That's why she could not be in today. So very unfair. I think that each and every one of us must put her in our prayer. Because it's only through God that he can be able to go through and pass through that difficult process. But I know that a lot of members in this committee almost went through the similar process, but we're happy that all of them actually came back better. We pray that even her, she'll come back better, because we need her in her, on her chair. And then I'll also welcome the department.
Not
in
your chair.
Yeah. In her chair. This one. And then I'll also welcome the department. As you can look at the agenda, we are having only two things on the agenda, the ETI's response on the steel industry. The ETI's response on the steel industry, and then the consideration of the request from the Minister on Trade Unions to recommend a board member. As we know that Mr. Shabang passed on sometime before we went for constituency in June. And then number two, we're supposed to also be dealing with the minutes, because we had requested that the secretary to the committee must prepare the minutes, because it was quite a long time that we didn't have any minutes at the point. I think that is dangerous that we don't have those minutes, because we'll never know where we are. And then again, I'll also have to put an apology again for the secretary of the committee himself. He's in a hospital today. Also, we're having an engine appointment with a specialist concerning the eyes. I don't know what's the problem with the eyes, but he indicated yesterday that, but he said that if things are well, he'll join us. But we also must wish him well. Let's hope that everything is alright with him. Because you know, we see the world through our eyes. Without our eyes, it's very difficult. Things can be difficult. So we must also put him in our prayers as we move forward. Without the waste of time, I'll request the Deputy Director General, Mr. Zarko, to introduce this delegation again, and then introduce this delegation. and fire on, but I also want to welcome the visitors to this cultural community today. I don't know who they are. Will you please be able to collect their names and who they are representing? Because I don't want to have a situation by what indicated that we have closed up the press out of this meeting. I want to know who in the Zoom. So that we don't have to be for that. All right, Honorable President.
Do we have any indication of when our chairperson should be able to join us again?
The chairperson, she'll only be able to indicate tomorrow, because the operation is this afternoon. It's only tomorrow that she'll be able to indicate. Yeah. All right. Deputy Director Drenner, can you fire on?
Thanks very much, Chair. The delegation from the Industrial Development Division of the DTI, next to me is Ms. Tansy Pele, who's the Chief Director of the Metal Fabrication, Capital and Transport Equipment, Chief Director from DTI, and we'll jointly be doing the presentation. And then we're also accompanied by Mr. Garth Stratton, who's the Chief Director of Industrial Policy. Thank you. Let me then kick off by starting with just tracing through the iron ore, steel, and steel product value chain in South Africa. And we believe it's important to look at this whole matter from a value chain perspective that runs through essentially four stages of beneficiation, going from the mining stage, which is stage one, through to the iron making stage, which is stage two, the stage three, which is primary steel production, and stage four, which is steel fabrication. It's also important to add that in South Africa, the primary steel production is quite highly concentrated. There's a strong degree of market concentration, and this can be viewed both in terms of flat products, flat steel products, such as coil, sheets, strips, and plate, where ArcelorMittal South Africa has approximately an 80% market share, and long products such as bars, rods, tubes, profiles, and sections, where there is a bit more competition, but the dominant player is ArcelorMittal South Africa. Then the value chain moves through to steel fabrication sector. And one of the points that we'll be making quite strongly in this presentation is that it's really in the steel fabrication part of the value chain, or the stage four of beneficiation, that the high levels of value added and job creation what are derived when one reaches that stage of production. So this table demonstrates the developmental gains the further one moves down the value chain. And one can look at this in a couple of ways. And one way one can look at it is to look at the selling price per ton of steel of some of the major products as we move through the different stages of beneficiation. So at the stage of iron ore, because it takes about 1.5 tons of iron ore to make one ton of steel, and at kind of international commercial prices of iron ore, the selling price of a ton of iron ore embodied in a ton of steel is about $180 per ton. As one moves down through the value chain, there's greater value addition in the steel making process. So, for instance, when you get to hot rolled coil, it's around $585 per ton. That's the selling price. Cold rolled coil, $685 per ton. Once you get down into the even towards the end of that chain in slightly more value-added products like pipe and tube, steel pipe and tube, selling price would go up. But what also happens is that the employment intensity per 1,000 tons of steel processed per annum goes up very considerably. And then as one moves further down the value chain into things like structural steel, steel that goes into construction, into a range of other related activities, there's a very significant increase in value add to around $3,000 per ton of steel embodied in that structural steel, and the employment intensity also goes up very considerably. We think that it's probably around it's a minimum of about 30 jobs per 1,000 tons of steel processed by the structural steel sector. That can be as high as actually 70 jobs per 1,000 tons of steel processed by that sector. And what we also see is that when one gets into the stage four of beneficiation, the investment required per job also comes down quite considerably. So it's much less capital intensive. So in the region of about R500,000 of investment per job is required in the structural steel sector. When one moves into very high value-added products, such as things like articulated dump trucks for the mining sector, you can see that there's a further massive jump in the selling price of the fabricated product per ton of steel. So going up in this case to around $13,700 per ton, and the employment per 1,000 tons of steel processed per annum similarly goes up, also at a much less capital-intensive way than is required in the iron ore mining and the steel processing part of the value chain. So we believe that this is very important because clearly what's critical to our reaching our developmental objective of raising value added and increasing employment is the relative attractiveness and profitability of these downstream steel fabrication industries. And the very strong contention that we make in this presentation is that one of the fundamental determinants of that profitability and viability is the pricing of steel itself. We move to tracing the evolution of the steel industry and policy towards the steel industry in South Africa. Both in a whole range of developing countries as well as South Africa, the steel industry has always been treated as strategic for industrialization. And right through its history, the steel industry in South Africa has benefited from very substantial public support over the duration of its existence. ISGOR was created by the state in 1927, and it was treated as a strategic asset by the apartheid government. Even when it was privatized in 1989 by the apartheid state, significant public shareholding was retained through the IDC. Subsequent to that, government has afforded substantial support for the restructuring and strengthening of the steel industry, particularly but not exclusively during the latter half of the 1990s. So the kinds of support that the industry received over this period included intervention by the South African government to try and avert anti-dumping duties by the US government, putting in very substantial public resources through the IDC to build the Saldanha plant between 1996 and 1999, which ISGOR then acquired full control of in 2002. various tax incentives, section 37E and 37H tax incentives were made available to the industry over the years to invest and expand. And then in 2001, as we all know, there was the unbundling of ISCOR into its mining and steelmaking components, with the mining part becoming Kumba and ISCOR then being reduced to only the steelmaking part of the business. And in order to achieve two public developmental objectives, there was an arrangement that was put in place for cost plus 3% access to iron ore for around 6.25 million tons from the Tishan mine with the objective of achieving two things along the value chain. The first was to ensure the viability and cost competitiveness of local steel production itself. But this was not the ultimate end of these public developmental obligations. The second component was also to ensure that there's a competitive steel pricing regime to support the development and deepening of value-added manufacturing products in downstream industries, which, as I've indicated, are the industries where there's substantial employment creation potential. At that time, L&M, which subsequently became ArcelorMittal, was introduced as an international business partner. And one of the elements of that arrangement was that there was a business assistance agreement which was put in place whereby L&M was required to introduce significant efficiencies in ISCOR. In exchange for this, they received very generous fees and also the right to continuously raise their shareholding. So between 2001 and 2004, L&M steadily increased its shareholding in ISCOR. In 2004, L&M sought majority shareholding in ISCOR, and this required competition tribunal approval. DTI has been consistently raising its concerns that the pricing of steel was not ensuring the developmental outcomes that we would want to see. And as a consequence, at that time, DTI engaged with L&M, and in 2004, just prior to the merger, there was an agreement between DTI and L&M that as soon as possible after attaining a majority shareholding in ISCOR, L&M would firstly conclude a steel pricing agreement with DTI that would replace the prevailing import parity pricing model with a developmental pricing model that would raise the volume of downstream steel beneficiated in the South African economy for both the export and domestic markets. It also committed to increasing investment in liquid steel capacity from around 6 million tonnes per annum to 9 million tonnes per annum. What this agreement effectively acknowledged is that the prevailing pricing policy, namely import parity pricing, was not capable of realizing these downstream developmental objectives. Since then, L&M has gone through a number of corporate iterations as it's engaged in mergers and acquisitions globally, but it ultimately became ArcelorMittal and its subsidiary here in South Africa, and the successor of ISCOR is now ArcelorMittal South Africa. We think that it's important at this point to elaborate a bit on the nature of import parity pricing and what that means for the pricing of steel. And this graph demonstrates how import parity pricing is conducted based on an example from 2004 from the way that ISCOR priced at the time. So essentially, when a steel company like ISCOR at that time wants to sell steel, it broadly has two possibilities. It can sell steel into the export market, or it can sell steel to domestic customers. Now, if it sells steel in the export market, it has to deliver that steel to an international customer at a given international price. In this case, the prevailing price in Europe was around $480 per ton. Now, in order for ISCOR at the time to deliver steel to that international customer, they would have to incur a series of actual costs to get that steel to the international customer. So, if it's, in this case, it's hot rolled coil, which is made in the Van der Bijl plant, which is inland in Gauteng, it has to be transported. It would have to be transported from inland to the port in Durban. It would have to be shipped by sea to a European port. At that European port, there would be import duties. The prevailing import duties would have to be paid. And then there are a range of other fees, warpage fees, commissions, and inland delivery to the customer in Europe. So as a consequence of that, even though the export price is $480 per ton, the actual net price that is earned is $376 per ton in this example, because you would have to pay all those costs to actually get the product to the customer in an export market. Now, so actual costs are incurred if you export steel, actual logistics and transport related costs. Now, by contrast, the rationale of import parity pricing is to say, if you are a monopoly producer in a market like South Africa, if you want to price up to the point that you can, the highest price that you can achieve, then you have to price up to the point that is equal to the next alternative for a South African company to buy steel, and its only alternative in the case of a monopoly is to import steel. So the import parity pricing is essentially a process of adding a whole lot of notional costs, or one could say almost fictitious costs, the costs that are not actually incurred, starting off with an international price, such as the $480 per ton, and then saying what would it cost to import steel, to ship it from, say, Europe to Durban. The customer would have to do that. They would have to pay an import duty if an import duty was in place in South Africa. Offloading and admin costs. What is also added is a so-called hassle factor or local premium that takes into consider, you know, that also prices in the hassle of importing steel. And then if you're an inland customer, if you're located in Gauteng, then there would also be an additional inland transport cost. So the import parity pricing is really adding all these notional costs. And in this example, it would then take the price up to around $690 per ton, or about 25% above the export price. So that's effectively how import parity pricing works and is conducted. Now, I think from the point of view of downstream steel development, I think it's obvious why DTI API has been concerned about this and has wanted to secure more developmental pricing arrangements for the downstream steel fabricators. And to this end, we've been engaged in extensive negotiations with ArcelorMittal since 2004. And effectively, we tabled two sets of proposals. The first was to say that we would like to see export parity pricing in the South African market. In other words, no discrimination between the prices that are charged to export customers and the prices that are charged to domestic customers. This was rejected. We subsequently said an alternative is that we propose a kind of basket price methodology, and our proposal was essentially as follows: that the price in South Africa should, in the first instance, match steel prices on average against the market where our major steel fabrication imports come from. So in other words, in the first instance, we should have steel that puts us at least on the same footing as the steel that our competitors in the steel fabrication sector are up against from products that are imported into South Africa. So we were saying half of that basket should reflect the ability to compete against imports of fabricated steel products, but also that given the cost advantage of the cost plus three iron ore arrangement, that it should also factor in this advantage and pass on some of this advantage, and therefore the other half of our proposed basket should comprise of the average price of steel in the lowest quarter of global steel pricing, which corresponds with the position that the cost plus three iron ore arrangement placed ArcelorMittal in terms of its cost of production of steel. So it's in the lowest quartile. It has been in the lowest quartile of the cost of production of all steel plants in the world, and we'll show this in a second. And therefore, there should be some kind of corresponding pass-through of that benefit, not passing through even necessarily the full benefit, but at least some of that benefit being passed through. AMSA rejected both of these. They would not accept either of these proposals, either an export parity model or a model that was in any way linked to their cost of production. Then we think that that's quite significant for what subsequently transpired. In 2006, they unilaterally introduced what they called an international basket price model, which is meant to be an average of prices in four countries, two high cost, two low cost, the USA, Germany, China, and Russia. But in addition to that, they've always said that they would supplement this international basket with information from their own global pricing within their global group, as well as whatever domestic adaptations they would want to make to this international basket. Now, when we try and replicate as DTI this basket, and we simply produce an average of these four countries, it bears no resemblance to the actual price that Mittal have been charging while this international basket price system has been in place. And what we'll demonstrate is that prices have actually been very significantly higher than a simple weighted average of those four countries. Just the last point before I ask Tani to then talk to some of the figures is that in 2006 there was a unilateral introduction of this international basket price system. You didn't agree to it, it wasn't a consensus. But then, similarly in 2009, there was AMSA unilaterally departed from this international basket price system. As we know, AMSA failed to convert its mining rights in 2009, in 2010 there was an unraveling of a substantial dispute around the mining rights and supply arrangements between ArcelorMittal South Africa and Kumba Iron Ore. And in order to, as an interim arrangement, there's an agreement that has been struck between ArcelorMittal South Africa and Kumba Iron Ore while they work their way through this commercial dispute, which has raised the price of iron ore to ArcelorMittal. And in order to deal with that, they initially introduced an iron ore surcharge, and they subsequently assumed that iron ore surcharge into the base price of steel. So one of the contradictions we believe is that one of the objections to a cost-linked pricing model, or the model that we proposed, is that there was an objection to linking cost of production with pricing in the domestic market. But when actual cost of production went up, because iron ore prices went up as a consequence of this mining rights matter and the dispute, then the additional cost of production was added to the steel price and passed on to downstream steel fabricators. And we believe this is a major contradiction. I'm going to ask my colleague Tandy then to continue with the presentation, and I will then wrap up at the evening.
Thanks, DDG. Just starting to initially show the position of Middle South Action, ArcelorMittal South Action plan on the global cost curve. It's based on the 2008 data, but the proportions in terms of the movement in the global cost curve has really changed significantly. Firstly, it shows that for Saldana, the cost of distance arrangement has provided ArcelorMittal with a massive cost advantage, which has resulted, which has placed the plant in the lowest, the lowest or the first quartile of the global cost curve. However, these cost advantages have never been passed on to the downstream steel fabricators, as the DDG has indicated. Since 2004, middle prices have always been above the world average, with an exception of 2008. The line that is showing you middle's prices is the line, the red bar on the graph. In most of these years, from 2004 to 2010 to date, January to July as an average, their prices have always been in the highest group of steel prices globally, with 2005 and 2009 being the highest amongst the countries that we compare with in our comparison. As mentioned, the actual prices charged do not resemble, as the DDG has indicated, do not resemble the average of the four countries that they have claimed to be in this international basket price. And indeed, had they implemented the basket price consistently, in some years it wouldn't have been far apart from the proposal that we put on the table at the DTI about the 50% being denoting the cost advantage that emitters enjoy, and then the 50% giving the advantage to, or putting us in the same equal footing with the countries that import with. How does this price really relate to import credit pricing? The prices for metal have varied. Has varied over the prevailing period. In some years it has exceeded IPP. In some years it has been slightly below IPP. So effectively the pricing system has not really resulted in the developmental outcomes that we had intended to get out of the unbundling process and the 2004 agreement. As indicated, these are the prices that METAR charges to the domestic market. It needs to be added that METAR also offers a number of rebates and discounts. One of the rebates is for value added exports, where a domestic fabricator would buy a steel at the prevailing domestic price. Subsequent to exporting the value added product, they would get a rebate, the difference between the prevailing domestic price and the export parity price. They also offer a number of industry specialties, for example, where steel products are under threat from alternative imports, such as ceramic instead of steel roof sheeting, for example. They also have a number of industry specific deals, such as in the automotive and the packaging industry. However, all these things are in at the discretion of Metal South Africa. So therefore, steel prices since 2004 cannot in any meaningful sense fit the criteria of the developmental pricing model as it was contemplated by the 2004 agreement. What has been the performance of the iron ore industry? Firstly, the graph shows that since 1990 to 2008, there's been a growing divergence between the domestic sales and the export sales of iron ore. Domestic sales, therefore, the beneficiated iron ore into steel products has fluctuated around 10,000 tons per annum for almost the two decades. Annual exports of iron ore have increased dramatically from around 15,000 tons per annum in 1991 to over 30 tons in 2008. So therefore, this picture basically is telling us that as a country, we are exporting more and more unbeneficiated iron ore without significantly raising the levels of domestic iron ore beneficiated in South Africa. This graph shows the performance of the South African steel industry in terms of the domestic sales for domestic consumption. Domestic sales in terms of value-added products, primary steel exports and imports. Overall, over the long term, steel sales in terms of volume have not increased significantly. Since the late 1970s, the volumes have fluctuated around 7 to 8 million tons per annum, with the exception of the recent period where we have seen an expansion basically in the back of the public investment. However, the total sales subsequently declined in 2008 and 2009 at the back of the economic global recession. In terms of the sales to domestic industries for domestic consumption, we have seen a similarly limited long-term growth. Although we have seen a stagnant growth in terms of volume per value-added products, ranging around 500,000 tons per annum. The key driver to growth in the steel production and sales is a growing downstream steel fabrication sector, which the GDG has already indicated that the steel pricing plays a key role in terms of the viability and the sustainability of the downstream industry. In terms of output, while the other graph, the graph before, indicated the volume, the steel volume over a long period, and have not really received the significance. There's been a, this graph shows that there's been a divergence, a growing divergence between the relative performance of the basic and steel sector and the two main downstream sectors, that is metal products and machinery and equipment. You know, to take forward the same the same language we've been using, basic iron and steel denotes primary steel production or primary steel sales, and the downstream industries are showed by the metal fabrication. The metal fabrication sector is denoted by metal products and the machinery and equipment sector. The basic iron and steel sector has really benefited from the restructuring arrangement as the GDP indicators of the late 1990s and subsequently the dramatic increases in global steel prices particularly from 2001 and going forward. The downstream industries have shown some growth, particularly since 2000, and in the recent times it's also been assisted by the public investment, capital investment program. In terms of employment, the growth in terms of output has resulted in important employment gains in the downstream industry since 2000, but then a subsequent decline, obviously following the global meltdown. It's important to note that there has been very significant job losses in the primary steel industry during the 1990s as part of the restructuring process of the sector. If a reasonable share of the benefits of the cost plus 3% arrangement has been passed through the downstream sectors as it was intended, these employment losses incurred in the primary steel production could have at least somehow been offset by the gains or the greater group job sales in the downstream sectors. In terms of the producer price index or the data, we see a divergence between the upstream and the downstream sectors. Prices in the basic iron and steel rose consistently and dramatically, particularly since 2001. In the domestic industry, these price increases were passed to the downstream industries, who were only in part were able to pass the price increases to their customers, but they had to absorb a larger part of the auto price increase. This table basically shows the importance of steel as an input to a number of downstream activities. This is denoted in terms of value. If we talk about volumes, the numbers would increase substantially. Obviously, there are a number of factors that influence the performance of the downstream industries, that is the metal fabrication and the machinery sectors. This includes issues of currency, global economy, and their own efforts to raise their competitiveness. However, steel prices are fundamental determinants of the competitiveness of the sector. This is because steel prices make up a large proportion of the production cost of the sector. The direct steel costs range from around 18.4% for food machinery to about 32% for structural steel metal products. When the indirect costs are added, because sometimes you buy as a structural steel manufacturer, you also outsource part of the components. So if you were to add that as part of your production cost, it really increases substantially to about 42.7%. In 2005, the DTI conducted some firm survey, which indicated the responsiveness of firms, of which indicated how the firms respond to changes in the steel prices. If steel prices were 10% lower, 22% of the firms indicated that they would increase their employment by about or by more than 10%. If this Thus, if the reduction in steel prices were about 20 or 30%, more than 45% and 7% indicated that they will also increase employment by more than a significant amount.
To wrap up, in order to respond to the unraveling of the one element of the 2001 unbundling arrangement, namely associated with the mining rights around iron ore and supply arrangements for iron ore from the mining sector to the steel sector, the ministers of trade and industry, economic development and minerals resources established an interdepartmental task team to not only focus on the iron ore pricing arrangement, but also to recall that the original intent of the 2001 unbundling was supposed to have two components to it. The one was concessional iron ore to the steel sector so that it could be competitive, viable, but secondly, so that it could also pass on some of those benefits to the downstream steel fabrication sector where the value added and employment is. So this is the focus point of the work that has been mandated by the ministers to this interdepartmental task team. So the focus of the work is not on how should the spoils be shared of this iron ore arrangement. Should it relatively go more to the mining side, or should it relatively go more to the steel side? But rather, how is this given effect to right through the value chain? So the mandate of this interdepartmental task team is to make recommendations on appropriate policy tools to ensure that the public developmental obligations of the 2001 unbundling are given effect to, and in the long term, the viability, both the viability and cost competitiveness of the local steel industry, but also competitive steel pricing to support the development and deepening of value-added manufactured products in downstream industries. And broadly speaking, the range of policy tools that are amongst those being canvassed by the task team include in relation to the mineral rights regime, in relation to competition policy and legislation, in relation to trade policy, and also in relation to attracting further investment and competition in the steel sector. The process going forward is that the interdepartmental task team will develop recommendations, report back to the ministers on those recommendations, and also brief the respective portfolio committees on the recommendations coming out of this process. Thank you.
Primarily to how our own domestic industry has to be strengthened. And I strongly approve of the approach taken here. The second comment is really a puzzle about how feeble the DPI has been over 10 years. And that this task team should be given a time limit, that it should be asked by this committee to take a vigorous approach and not a technical approach. It should follow the general lines that Nimrod has taken. And I would love to have the former ministers in DPI come here and tell us what the hell they were doing in the name of our country. Because really, they were taken for such a ride by Mittal. Surely they understood. And the consequence of this, 10 years ago, has been deindustrialization, huge job losses. I mean, I recall when ISCOR was going through this process, and they fired thousands of skilled workers who are now in Dubai or God knows where. And we saw it, and we knew it. What were they thinking, the people who were running the DTI at that time? And if it were possible, we should call them here. Probably it's not possible. But really, I think the committee should make a comment about that. The responsibility of the people in charge of DTI 10 years ago, and public enterprises for that matter, to us today are huge. And their failures should be noted by this committee. Thank you. And will excuse me, please. I have to go to another meeting. So I just, it's not a question, it's just a comment. I approve very much of the approach taken here today, and I'm very critical of the approach taken over the last 10 years, and I hope that the DPI is going to develop some muscle because the country requires it.
Thank you, Chair. And I want to agree to a very, very large extent with the Honourable Turok. He could just have spoken, you know, from the DA economic policy. So there's a lot of similarities, you know, between us in that regard. What is quite evident from a lot of this information and the graphs is that there was an increase in the export of raw material, non-beneficiated products. And there's a decrease in the export of value-added products. So certainly that has not helped employment, it has certainly not helped the earning of foreign currency, it has certainly not helped to grow our economy. So that is very, very important. And rather than help and assisting a company like ArcelorMittal to make huge profits, DTI must rather be very, very creative in terms of their incentive schemes. And I know that in the past we have talked a lot about, and during the discussions about IFAP 2, is about, you know, what they refer to as behind the border incentives and support. And we, to use a very good example, in the DTI government is investing enormous lot of money in the automotive development production program. But car manufacturers are still importing sheet metal for bodies. It's not produced in South Africa. Now, how on earth can we invest so much money in an investment program, and you don't look at the beneficiation of local products? My goodness, that boggles my mind. And one can go an enormous lot further. If you look at ArcelorMittal, nowhere have I seen, you know, whether you've made a calculation, what is an acceptable profit margin for them? You know, it's one of the few businesses that I've seen and experienced in my life where there's no way that they cannot be viable. Because, I mean, they start from the point of making sure that they make excessive profits. And how on earth can you allow a price structure where they incentivize exports. It's not supposed to be them that makes that incentivize exports. It must be government that incentivizes exports of value-added steel products. It means that they, because I mean, what do they earn from exports? Nothing. From other people exporting steel products, nothing. It means that somehow, I don't know if that was part of the agreement between DTI over the last 10 years and ArcelorMittal, but I found that incredibly difficult to grasp. Just to come back to that graph of yours about the export parity prices, I would like to know, are you assuming that the Ex Works prices abroad is $480 per ton? And where is that? Is that in Russia? Is it in China? Or is it somewhere in Africa? Because most certainly one must do a proper cost-benefit analysis. Because, you know, from cost-benefit analysis, one must see what is the alternative that we have that can benefit our economy. You know, if we spend this money by supporting, for instance, small business, will you benefit the same way? Because to go and subsidize, in inverted brackets, an industry purely to make sure that somehow this is viable in a global arena, I cannot see, you know, it doesn't work with any other business. Why should it work here? If you can respond to some of that, thank you.
Thank you, Chair. I just want to say, you know, when last day, after the meeting we were here presenting, we made note that they did not bring any presentation in terms of traffic. But there was a bit of them leading us into how there was so much beneficiation in what we were doing. I think I even commented that that's what we need in terms of mining, because in mining we actually export our raw materials without any beneficiation. But with what the DTI stigmas now, it still shows that really there's very, very little or none beneficiation. My question then is, even though there is that internal process, this committee that is going to be looking at this inter-ministerial committee, are there any very time frame for this committee to really make sure that we are able to do this? I don't want to go back to history what Professor Turok has mentioned, but do we have really time frame to turn around, you know, this thing, because our natural resources are benefiting other countries more than, and when we have serious problems of unemployment in this country. We want time frame, we want a monitoring tool that is going to see into this. And perhaps if the department is able to say to us, within a year, we want to have turned around so much and have turned around, done so much in terms of turning this around and creating these jobs. When as a portfolio committee we visited the Eastern Cape motorists, you know, there is something that we want to see in this country. It might have some progress in terms of reporting, but the skills that our people in this country are benefiting, that we saw there, is really something we've got to take on. The sequencing thing that, you know, because it's something that we know as a country that we have really made our people acquire those skills there, and that is actually, increasing the kind of really important skills that we don't have in this country. I also think that, how are we going to enforce this? I don't know why it was not enforced previously. The 50-50 thing you're talking about, how are we going to make sure that these people apply this? Because rather than them, you know, incentivizing, as they were saying, they were incentivizing other companies. I agree, it's not that easy to do that, government incentivizing. How are we going to make sure that this is really happening without just laying everything in writing and putting it and not making sure that it does happen? Because we as a committee would need to be reported to us from time to time about how that process is going or actually turning the whole thing around. Thank you.
you, and thank you particularly also for the presentation. I would agree that the committee, notwithstanding the report that they that were given here, should maybe not lose focus of what our objectives are. And they are chaired to create a labor-intensive industry and to create labor-intensive beneficiation industry. And if that is the case, Chair, then we would appreciate what the department says, that, you know, they're going to be forming all of these things. But I think the committee should independently, as part of their oversight responsibility, map out an independent program that would lead towards the objective that we would want. So while the department is going to put all of that together, I think we should first of all examine, does our legislation assist in this process? And if our legislation does not assist, we should do something about that. I'm saying this, Chair, because I got very worried when the department says that we're going to put together this committee, and, you know, they rejected this, all the things that they rejected of you. And my immediate question in my mind was, well, what tools do they have? If the Competition Commission can't assist in this instance, maybe they can. But we're not hearing sufficiently the department speaking about strengthening additional tools or the existing ones. And that's why I'm saying, Chair, as legislators, we must find that does this legislation that we currently have assist the process of labor intensiveness, industries, and beneficiation. And then I think, Chair, I'm not going to spell out because it's a proposal that I'm making, and if it's accepted, then of course, you know, we can put the meat onto the bones of this program of independently ourselves working out what it is that we need to do. I do want to ask, though, that the department on the pricing issue, what other options have you explored on the pricing, apart from what you have said there, which they have partly rejected and unilaterally carried on with their own decision? Have you considered any pricing arrangements? You know, for example, you get things like a spot price. You get something that you can do at the beginning of a fiscal year. I'm not saying you should. I'm asking, do you consider those kind of proposals? Because what we would want in South Africa, we want to create jobs. We want to make sure that these industries, and so there's got to be a dispensation on the pricing model that takes that objective into consideration. I think we have it the other way around. We are bothered about Kumba and all of them, whether the pricing model benefits them. I'm not saying we should be reckless. But does the pricing model benefit the kind of objectives that we would have over and above what you are saying? And maybe you should unpack the... Oh, by the way, I also said they never of what did you think? The a developmental... if they don't know what that is, could you assist them? So maybe they would then understand it, and then maybe they would agree with your proposal. Chair, so if they can unpack to us what is this developmental pricing in their view at least, because they were explaining developmental pricing. And then lastly, Chair, I want to find out how is the value chain been taken into consideration in moving forward in the proposal that you are making. And I want to end up by saying that what I said the last time is that we do think that the department has got to act with much more vigor when there's market failure. I don't think we need more workshops. We don't need much more analysis. what we do need is a program that brings us closer to our objective, and here is a classical case. We need to be convinced otherwise that it is not a market failure a problem. If it's not, then what else is it then? And if you agree with that, then we need much more rigor. I won't go the direction that Honorable Turok has said. If we go that direction, then I would ask, investigate the clothing industry also that has been failing minute by minute, and bring all of the others that have caused the industry to fail also. So if we go that direction, we might as well call all the industries and find out why we failed so much. Thanks.
Well said to the Buddhists here by Lama Rant. The precursor from my side is that thank God into communists that the Acelometer Kuma saga has come up, because it has opened our eyes to the significance of strategic products to our program, whether it's IPAP 2 or the new growth path. I think that's more than anything to me, the most fundamental thing. I had a look at this last night, and I didn't understand some of the graphs, but now I'm very grateful that my eyes have been opened, that there's been more flight of primary products rather than beneficiation. And it surprises me. Or maybe it shouldn't be even surprising, because what is expected of industry in South Africa is to support the government program, and amongst other things is to emphasize on beneficiation programs. I won't say much because my colleagues have raised a number of things in that regard. Chair, I've been looking at the document that has been presented to us. I just want to check before I make a couple of proposals, but is my understanding correct that the iron and steel industry is, or the government is still maintaining the old position that the iron and steel industry is still a strategic, particularly in what I would regard as the re-industrialization campaign. Number two, in 2004, the LNM sought for majority shareholding, and the question I have is that why was this allowed if iron and steel is regarded as strategic? The rest will be my comments once I get the response. I mean, proposal in the next round. Chair, thanks.
Thank you, Chairperson. The first question has to do with the graph that is up on the screen right now. I know the source is not the DTI's calculations. I see they cite the source there as ISCOR, probably from one of the ISCOR documents. Now, my question is, how can we have so many transport costs in that cost structure? Something doesn't make sense to me. If we take it from the bottom, we talk about the ISCO X works price. Now, if we are talking about import parity pricing, my first impression would be that we would start with the world price of this type of steel. And then we can add on the transport from the coast to inland, what is then blue, shipping cost to Durban, from the other country. Then the import duty, offloading, etc., and then the transport to Gauteng. For me, only that what you've shaded in blue there should be added to what is an international price to get an parity price in the in Gauteng. So please, if you could tell me, why is there that difference between the 376 and the 480? That I don't understand. The second thing is also, it seems to me, and I'm now referring to one of the other graphs which said cost structures. Let me just see, I think it's one that comes off the one that, that you later you have it. Thank you. It seems to me as if the Saldanha plant's pricing is highly competitive if you look at world steel prices. Yet I have heard threats of the Saldanha plant being closed down, etc. If you could just give me some of the rationale behind that, because it seems to me if you've got a highly effective plant running, that you should actually be looking at expanding that plant and not making noises or threats of shutting it down. If there are other factors influencing that decision, please share that with me. Thank you.
All right, I think we have to assume to your question, although I had it myself. For example, on the issue of the interim price mechanism, what power does the testing have in stopping that type of looting taking place? Because this one is basically looting. What is happening here? What power does the interdepartmental testing have? And then number two, I think I'll concur with Honorable Dorok that really we could not allow, perhaps we might not get the former minister, but the people who were functionaries in the department can be able to get them. Because no, it's fine. But what is critical is that we do need to see that memorandum of understanding which they had when they abandoned the ISKU. Because really we cannot afford to have that repetition again. Because you can see that this thing is the looting of the resources of South Africa. We've got this iron ore which is so cheap, instead of benefiting us, benefiting other countries. So I think that we cannot, as this parliament and control committee, sit back and look as if nothing has happened. I think there must be some sort of a redress which must come along the way. All right. Can pass on.
Thanks, Chair. I will try and answer a number of the questions. I'll also ask Tandy to address a couple of the questions. I think particularly some of the pricing-related questions, the question on how do Ex-Works prices compare, let's say, in Europe to Ex-Works prices here, as well as the question on the build-up and the numerous transport costs going from Ex-Works to international to import parity. Perhaps I could just start off by saying that I think a number of issues have been raised around the task team. I think both the powers and the work and the timing of the task team. I think the mandate of the task team is to make recommendations to the ministers, and that obviously can include, where relevant, changes to policy, changes to the use of existing instruments, and if necessary, changes to legislation. So I think those are all within the remit of the task team. The ministers at this point have not set specific kind of deadline for the completion of the work of the task team, but they certainly, our minister has instructed us, to try and expedite this work as rapidly as possible. I certainly don't believe, we're talking about a year down the line. I think we're talking about a month, 6 weeks, maybe 2 months down the line. But I think what we need to also relay back to our ministers is the comments of the task team that the specific time frames do need to be set, and we will certainly do that. I think also some questions, comments have been raised about the specifically the DTI and the role of the DTI. But I think for us, what's quite significant and important, and I think we're approaching this both from a kind of an economic point of view and a policy point of view, is seeing the value chain as a whole, both from an economic perspective but also from a policy perspective. And I think that's been recognized in the establishment of this interdepartmental task force, because these methods cut across different departments along the value chain. So I think it's quite important for us to emphasize that. Then on some of the back to some of the specific questions. On the pricing front, you know, the one question that's been raised is, well, what is a developmental price? And you know, and has this been adequately conveyed by the DTI? And I think to reiterate, we made two proposals, and I think our second proposal probably captures, let's say, the upper limit of what a developmental price should be, which again, to reiterate, is a price which is reflective or places our manufacturers at least on an equal footing in the cost of the steel that they purchase with the price of steel that their competitors receive when they import steel-intensive fabricated products into South Africa. So that's the one element coming. The second is that there should be a passing through to the downstream steel sector of some of the advantages of the iron ore arrangement. So to us, that forms the upper limit of what can be considered a developmental steel price. You know, and one can make arguments for, you know, for even lower prices, such as an export parity price. But I think that we have conveyed in detail and at length our understanding of the rationale and the content of what a developmental steel price should embody. So from our point of view, it cannot be the case that that a developmental steel price has not been implemented because of a lack of understanding about what that means. That certainly cannot be the case. As I said, I'll ask Tani to respond on the questions on the transport costs. And the ex works part. I think dealt with the enforcement question in the sense that obviously you know, part of the mandate of the task team is to ensure that whatever, you know, mechanisms, policy tools are put in place, and these need to be enforceable. I think if we've learned one thing from this episode is that, you know, clearly moral suasion is not sufficient. We've attempted that over a very long period of time, and that has not been sufficient. I just want to double check that we are addressing all the questions that were raised by the members. I think there was also a point raised about, you know, that this should pay particularly attention to the downstream and the value addition And I think, again, we've tried to emphasize that the, particularly when one gets to the downstream fabrication of steel products, this is where the real developmental gains are made. It's in the fabrication part of the value chain where there's the relative employment intensity, where there are much higher levels of value addition. And again, the steel pricing, because steel fabrication, steel itself makes up such a significant proportion of the cost of steel fabrication, that the steel pricing is a fundamentally important factor in the competitiveness, viability, and profitability of the downstream part of the value chain. So I think I'll then hand over to my colleague Tandy to comment on the two other pricing related issues, and then perhaps I'll also come back to the question on the Saldanha plant. I just want to check, have I missed something that...
It was just the question of mine where I refer to the two graphs where this, you know, basic iron ore that's exported and the investment in the automotive program, development program, and the fact that sheet metal is imported and is not produced here, and what is the incentive that ETI is doing to, you know, to support their own investment program.
Let me try to respond to that briefly. Look, the way that the automotive program is constructed is that it does encourage local production and value add. So, and in fact, when steel is imported, then it is excluded from that, often excluded from that calculation. I think we do need to add that, look, there are certain very specialized steel products which we don't manufacture in South Africa, and that's why you'll see there's a small, relatively over time, there's a small proportion of steel imports, and a significant part of that is some specialized steel products. It may be the case that some of those specialized steels are being used in the automotive sector, but we don't, in general, incentivize steel that is imported as part of the automotive program.
My question was, how do you incentivize there's iron ore flowing out, there's an increase in ore value, non-value added, and an increase in value added. If you invest so much money in the automotive development program, shouldn't you incentivize local beneficiation sheet metal for the automotive program,
yeah,
rather than basically allowing that industry, because it's a huge investment of the country, and allowing basically them to import. Shouldn't that be incentivized to keep exactly on that?
Well, I think I attempted to answer the question by saying that the architecture of the program does precisely incentivize that. And it doesn't incentivize imported steel. But there may be certain cases where the automotive industry does need to import steel. And I think that the automotive industry is one of the single biggest purchasers of and users of local steel. So as far as we're aware, I think the by and large, and there may be some exceptions, but the auto industry does use significant amounts of local steel. I can't really find a better way to answer the question.
All right, I think the question will ask it this way. What happens when we encourage to incentivize them to do that? What happens if they don't do that? Take the example, that method I think is very important when coming to the formation of the board of the car, but the majority of that does not come from it. What do you do? When does what happen?
Well, what will happen is that imported part, or the imported raw material, will not be included in the calculation of the incentive, and so it will, it will reduce the amount of incentive that an automotive company gets because it's excluded from the calculation of the incentive itself. So that's how local fabrication and value add is incentivized, and conversely, the exclusion of imported material in the calculation of the incentive is discourages imports. Can I suggest? I mean, if, you know, what we're certainly happy to submit a more detailed written kind of explanation. You know, we would be certainly very happy to do that.
Thanks, Jay. I will go into greater detail to explain the numbers on this graph. The starting point of this graph is that if you are an ArcelorMittal plant in South Africa, you want to sell in the export market. First of all, you have to match the international price to which you want to sell into. For example, if we are assuming that the 480 dollars per ton is a price that is prevailing in Germany, for example. Yeah. Sitting in South Africa, you've got to ensure that you deliver your goods in Germany to be able to sell your goods in Germany something comparable to that international price. But then you are sitting here in South Africa, so first of all, you have to move the goods from your plant to get them to the plant in Germany. So in order to move that, first you, for example, the final very plant is an Indian plant. So first of all, you have to incur transport costs from the plant, final bale, to Devon, which is the first element of that thing. Then the second element is that you have to ship the goods to get to the port on the other side. That's the second build-up. The third build-up, in the market where there's an import duty, you have to pay the import duty to get the goods into that market. And then other charges, you know, the commissioning and the delivery and other added costs. These are the real costs which you would incur if you are exporting. Then coming to the import parity pricing. In South Africa, where you have, for example, if we indicated that ArcelorMittal has got 8% market share in hot rolled coil, for example. Yeah. So as a customer to ArcelorMittal, how would ArcelorMittal price the good to? They will use, in a competitive market, the price will reflect the price of the other competitors in the market. So in the case where you have a monopoly, the best alternative for a customer to buy that material, it has to come from an import. Yeah. So where they start off is that if you were to, using the same example of Germany, if as a customer in South Africa, which you were to import the steel product from Germany, you start off with the international price, which is what we call the export price. Then you have to ship the goods from there to get them to the harbor in Devon. Then you have to pay the import duty. Then you have to pay the other admin and offloading costs, as indicated. And then you have to ship the goods from, you have to transport the goods from Devon, the harbor, to your factory inland. As we know, most of the fabricators, they are located mostly in housing. So you have to move the goods from Devon to get them to your plant inland. And as the DVD indicated, we have this what we call a hassle factor, which is an additional 5%. You know, they call it the hassle that you have to incur to import. So all in all, your import pricing, the import parity pricing, will end up at $619 per ton, compared to what you would have paid if you were an exporter of 480, or where the all the extra costs already incurred would have been at 376.
Perhaps I could also just add, the reason why the 5% import duty is highlighted is because at the time there was a 5% import duty in place in 2004. Now we subsequently removed that because we saw no reason to add import duty protection to this, you know, series of markups. So theoretically, you know, if to the extent that there's a pricing, a kind of mechanical exercise in pricing, you know, precisely on the point of import parity pricing, it would exclude that import duty element. But what it also shows is that import duty element is only a relatively small proportion, or was rather only a relatively small proportion of the overall import parity series of pricing markups.
All right, thanks for the responses. If there are follow-up questions, can we have 111 this time, please? All right, Honourable Mare, Honourable Panavadis, Honourable Shigara.
Just on that, you said that we assume the 480 is the free on board price in Germany, but obviously the iron ore was coming from Germany, so, and I mean that cost of $45 shipping cost to Durban must be based on shipping costs from somewhere. From China, from where is that shipping cost? And is that 480? The assumed free on board wherever, or is it the actual? And if it's not the actual, why are they actual? Because I mean, you can't work on assumptions. Assumptions, the practicality of assumptions will be higher margins, because nobody will assume that they're making a loss at that price.
My problem has still not been resolved. Import parity pricing, by definition, is the price that the purchaser can expect to pay for that commodity on the international market, plus the import costs to get it to his or her location. Now, therefore, I do not understand the part in white, below the blue shading, because I do not think if we would have a manufacturer of steel products in the Witwatersrand area, for example, or in Durban, that he or she would be subjected to all those costs. And also, I do not think those people will be buying their steel from Germany. So my question is still, what I want to know is how does that price, the calculated or the highlighted import parity price, how does that compare to what real import parity pricing would have been? I want to know, is ISCOR's price competitive in terms of the world, the price that they ask for South African industry entities? Is that comparable, or are we not at the point where it would be neither here nor there for people in the Witwatersrand, whether they buy ISCOR steel or whether they buy Chinese steel, for example. If you could just give me that comparison so that we know. There are some graphs, some very interesting graphs, which has to do with pricing over a number of years from 2004 to 2010. And there it seems as if ArcelorMittal, in some years, in terms of the comparisons that have been done here, were either the most expensive or for most of these years they were, you know, in the second or the third most expensive producer of steel. Whereas my common sense tells me we're a country that produces apparently a good quality of iron ore, we have vast amounts of cheap coal, used in large quantities, and still, why is it that ArcelorMittal's price comes out so high when compared to this basket? Please, I'm still looking for answers. Thank you.
Chair, I'm going to read my proposal and submit them in writing. I'm too fast because I'll be respecting time. First thing I'm proposing that we must embark on a monitoring evolution as well as getting regular updates, not only on this area, but on what can be identified as strategic industries and or sub-industries of strategic products. The emphasis is on strategic industries and strategic products. This has been triggered by this ArcelorMittal and Kumba saga. And that's the committee, which means the DTI should help us in both identification and the regular update exercise. As to the details, I'm sure the chair's office could look into that in consultation, all of us. The second point is to, there's a need to explore incentives for beneficiation programs, whether it's for the iron and steel, if it's not there, and even generally for the strategic products. And that's triggered by the very experience and presentation that has been given today. Linked to that is that can DTI explore regulation, either full or partial, on this matter? Apologies, Chair. I think you can sense I'm trying to be cool. I'm in a combative mode. And all that has been presented is just a manifest of why I'm in a combative mode. I know a number of people would cringe as to regulation, just the term regulation, but I'm very emphatic and assertive on that. Let DTI explore and come back to us. Because I think strategic industries or strategic products, if we had to bite the bullet, we've got to be biting the bullet and even explore regulation because of our re-industrialization drive in this country. The third point, Chair, is that we need more information on the steel pricing, whether locally or globally and historically. And if you could also explain some of the terms. We're allowing things to move because of respect and time, but we're still at odds grappling with some of these terms because they are relatively newer. That is iron and steel pricing, sorry, not just steel. And the other information one is requiring is the original intent of unbundling. References that's made to that, and also the progress thereof. And the third area of information, which I think Honorable September alluded to it, is the task team. Some creative way of informing us of what is happening there is very, very important if we are to handle this. The fourth and the last point, Chair, is that I strongly propose that we need to reciprocate the information of the task team, which has been done by the executive, and do it on our side as well as portfolio committee, trade and industry, economic development, mining, primarily. I don't know which one, other ones can be added. Probably public enterprise, because it seems there's still some thirst and hunger for privatization. And what we're handling, if I'm doing outright, is consequences of privatization. I don't know, it's up to the rest of the honorables to decide on the inclusion of public enterprise. And amongst other things that this task team from our side should look into is to ensure that there is broad consultation, whether local, continental, or global, on this. Focus will be on iron and steel, as well as in its impact on the EPAP 2, as well as the new growth path. And later, I feel that this task team should also carefully look at those carefully identified strategic industries and or products. Chair, why I'm having this long, winded list of proposals is because, to me, the significance of all that is happening is that I maintain that there is a risk, or it's already there, but the impact of this pricing, the impact of these shenanigans and maneuvering by these two companies is creating a likelihood of undermining our whole pre-industrialization drive, particularly in part two. Thank you.
Well, thank you for
the test is if you are just dealing with now. Oh, please, you have to have some time to consider it. I don't think that it's going to be able to just for one like that. And then we have to really interrogate it. Whether a lot of things a person will agree with them, I think that's also part of that. Let's give the department a chance to respond. I think also when after I've responded, you know, the other time we also had a presentation from ELCOM. I don't know whether we did get those presentations. Can you do something around that? ELCOM is very clear.
First of all, Chair, I realized that there was one question that was raised which we didn't answer, and that was the question about Saldana. You know, if Saldana at the beginning of 2008, which is, you know, what the start of the slate was at such a low, you know, low competitive level on the global cost curve, you know, why is it a threat? Why is it under threat now? I think that we don't know precisely what the situation is with Saldana. But I think what we can say is that given relatively low iron ore costs, if there was a significant deterioration in the cost situation of Saldana, it could only have been due to operational reasons. So that's one reason that would push Saldana up this cost curve and, you know, push it into the terrain where it might not be profitable. I think that's one element. I think another is that a lot of the output of Saldana is exported either directly or there's some further processing that's done by plants nearby Saldana called Defurco, and then that is then exported. And so the prices that are secured from the Saldana plant are lower because they export a relatively higher level of the output than the Thunder Bell plant. And so for the reasons that we've explained in this type of graph, you know, when you export, you have to incur the actual logistical related costs. Then I think to try and then move to the questions then that were put again on the detail of import parity prices. Let's start off again by saying that when you export according to you've got to meet an actual price in the export market, and in this case. We've said, you know, at that time, you know, roughly speaking, the price that prevailed was maybe around $480 a tonne in Europe. So that's an actual price you've got to meet, and you've got to bear a whole range of logistical and related costs in order to get that to market. But the converse is true when you set an import parity price, because when you set an import parity price, you start off with it's not an actual price. You pick a price. You know, or the way that ISCO was doing this in 2004 in a fairly mechanistic way was, they would use what they call the Black Sea price. So the price of steel in the Black Sea would be their benchmark, because they thought that's probably the most attractive price that a potential importer could obtain in the international market. And then they would say, what if a local company were to import, because that's the only alternative they have, either they buy from the store or they import. If they were to import, what would they pay? And then there's a series of these cost build-ups to set the price roughly at a level that somebody would pay if they had to import. Now, perhaps just to add an additional element which I think renders this a particular problem in South Africa is that in other markets there's a fair level of regional competition. But to deal with the capital-intensive industry, a lot of countries won't, individual countries, especially small countries, or countries with a small GDP, won't have a lot of steel plants because of the economies of scale. But within a region like Europe, or like East Asia, or South Asia, or North America, or South America for that matter, you will have some level of competition within the region. So if you're in Europe, you'll have, you'll have production in Germany, you'll have production in the UK and Spain and Italy and so forth. And that regional competition plays a role in disciplining prices within the region. One of the kind of unique situations of South Africa is that because of the relative underindustrialization of the sub-region of Southern Africa, we don't have a competing plant in Mozambique or Namibia or Botswana. And so you don't have this regional competition effect. So I think that's the one thing. I think the other point, the question is, what happens when, I think you're saying that you're fairly clear on what happens with this price of buildup when it goes into the export market, but you're saying, what about this white area below the line, below the 480 level when it sells into the domestic market? When it sells into the domestic market, those, what are reflected as actual costs for export sales, become additional notional costs for domestic sales. Because those costs aren't incurred either when you sell into the local market. So let me try and explain it in another quite crude way. Import parity pricing is a little bit like taking steel, exporting it to Europe, bringing it back to South Africa, and setting the price at that level. That's a crude analogy of roughly what the equivalent would be. Now, I think what we should also say when it comes, the next question is what are the actual prices? Well, the actual prices, these are the actual prices on average from 2004 through to 2010. Now, in some years there's been a fairly mechanistic, pricing according to import parity. So you'll see here that in 2004, the actual average price was $615, about $4 off the import parity example that we gave from 2004. But there hasn't necessarily been an absolute mechanistic kind of pricing according to this strict import parity calculation. I think what we're saying is it's fluctuated in the region of import parity, sometimes moving a little bit below, sometimes moving significantly above what would be a mechanistic calculation of import parity. Chair, I think we've covered the questions.
Chair,
I think we can be quite brief. I think there were two presentations that were made by ESCOM during the public hearing process. The first related to the local procurement and the linking of the ESCOM capital expenditure program to our localization efforts and our push around increasing localization through local procurement. I think that let me first Transnet also did a presentation on this. I think we've made quite a lot of progress, very significant progress with Transnet, particularly around securing commitments towards localization of trains and so on that they'll be purchasing. We have made, I think, some progress with ESCOM in jointly identifying areas where they will procure locally and engage in supply development. I don't think we're at the point, though, where we've made as much progress as we had with ESCOM. So, I think of one as Transnet. So what we're trying to do at the moment, together with the Department of Public Enterprises, is set up a formalized kind of set of interactions where the two departments and ESCOM meet on a regular basis and really try and push forward this issue of localization much more strongly, particularly within ESCOM. So we believe it's a matter, that also for the committee in its ongoing engagement to continue to keep an eye on. The other set of issues that were raised by ESCOM in its second presentation related to broadly to its approach to climate change and so forth. And I think broadly our response to the ESCOM presentation on climate change is that I think what ESCOM highlighted is that there are a number of policy processes that need to be finalized both by Department of Energy as well as by the National Energy Regulator in order to have a more meaningful contribution to, in particular, to renewable energy generation and efforts around demand side management, like the solar water heating program. So, for instance, we need the finalization of the integrated resource plan by the Department of Energy. We believe that should be completed fairly soon. And then the finalization of the arrangements for the purchase of power from independent power producers, including purchase from renewable generators. And that in turn links to the renewable, the refit pricing model that NERSA is putting in place. I think one of the areas where we're starting to work across a number of departments is to try and look towards international donors for additional resourcing to supplement the funding that will be put into the refit model. Because the more funding we can source, and there are indications globally that there is a willingness to provide funding, the larger levels of capacity we can afford to generate from renewables, because necessarily in order to generate renewable power, there's got to be a significant premium that's paid in terms of the refit model to those renewable producers. So we're engaged with a number of departments, including public enterprises and Department of Energy, around an initiative called the South African Renewables Initiative, which is aimed at trying to see if we can secure global funding for renewables and link that back to the manufacture of the metal and capital equipment and other equipment that then goes into the generation of those renewable facilities, like concentrated solar power and wind energy and so forth.
Thanks a lot for that input. I think that we have come to an end of this discussion we're having about this second report. And then what is also critical that is, I think that the Secretariat is to look at the responses of COBA from the figure to infrastructure committee. But what is also omitted here is the response of ELCOM and Afilometa. They are not here. So I think that we are going to prepare our supplemental report to accept those responses so that we can integrate with them with that. I think that the input of the department is very good and we highly appreciate that. In particular, the issue of having ELCOM regularly with the Department of Public Health so that push this thing of organization forward. Because that's the only way we are going to finish it. Locally, although there's indicated that there are a lot of things which they are already doing locally, which is highly appreciated, even the skills, the training which is involved, which is most fun. The fact that the GTI is the champion of this impact, that really pull them together, I think it's highly appreciated. All of the members, can we release the department now? I think that they've done the work. No question, no comment.
Thank you, Chair and honourable members.